Lecture 81, Carter and the Reagan Revolution.
Jimmy Carter, a born-again Christian with an unblemished moral reputation, benefited from Watergate to win the 1976 presidential race in a campaign which featured campaigning against Washington. He was unlucky, however, and confronted an ugly combination of economic stagnation and inflation, which was nicknamed stagflation. His economic woes were worsened by the Iranian Revolution of 1978-79, and the seizure of America's diplomats at Tehran as hostages. He fought off Edward Kennedy's challenge within his own party, but then lost in the November election to a right-wing Republican, Ronald Reagan. Reagan would not accept the bipartisan consensus of the last two decades. He escalated the Cold War by planning a new generation of space-based weapons, nicknamed Star Wars, and he aimed to cut taxes and diminish the reach of the federal government. His supply-side economics were designed to accelerate economic growth with a minimum of political intervention. He owed a political debt to the new religious right, which was in revolt against the recent decade's rapid moral changes. But he did little in practice to support their pro-family plans, which included outlawing abortion, restoring prayer in public schools, and combating feminism. Reagan had been a film star, and his masterful use of the media made him a popular president, even when sordid aspects of his foreign policy were exposed during his second term of office. Well, first of all, let's look at Jimmy Carter. He was a very unusual figure in the American presidency. Lucky to be elected in the first place, very unlucky in the circumstances he then confronted. First of all, he was a very active evangelical Christian, and that was something new in 20th century politics. And because he'd never had a job in Washington, he'd previously been the governor of Georgia, he was able to present himself as someone who was uncontaminated by Washington. The Watergate era created the impression that to be involved in politics inside the Beltway was itself to be contaminated. Now, as he began campaigning and as he began to declare himself a born-again Christian, these were views which surprised many journalists and policy analysts. He gave a controversial interview to Playboy magazine. The interview was conducted by Robert Scheer. And Carter was disarmingly frank about certain matters. For example, he confessed to Scheer that he'd lusted in his heart, that was his words, I lusted in my heart after certain other women. And he understood the power of the temptation to sin. And he went on to say, of course, a mature and responsible Christian man has to struggle against temptation. A lot of evangelical ministers were very angered that he should have appeared in the pages of Playboy in the first place. His family was also eccentric and provided a great deal of colourful material for media stories. They had almost a Flannery O'Connor flavour of a strange gothic group living in the old rustic South. His brother Billy Carter still had all the sharp edges which Jimmy Carter had removed through his practice of politics. Billy was beery, jovial, slightly bigoted. His mother, Ms. Lillian, was a throwback to earlier, simpler ages. So the media had a great time exploiting the unusual circumstances of Carter's early life. But nevertheless, he was a real professional politician. And in fact, he understood perfectly well that he could exploit and make the most of his unusual circumstances because of the conditions in America which he was responding to. After his success in 76, he defeated Gerald Ford in the 1976 election. He said that he was going to make respect for human rights central to his foreign policy. He was sincere in wanting to establish a foreign policy based on Christian principles, so far as that was possible. That's why he withdrew American support for the Shah of Iran, which had been in place for the last 25 or 30 years, because of the Shah's human rights abuses. And for the same reason, he withdrew American support for the Nicaraguan dictator Somoza. He also tried to promote lasting peace in the Middle East and was successful in arranging the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt in 1978. This is probably his most important and lasting contribution to the stability of the world. Israel had been constantly at war ever since its creation back in 1948. But Carter was able to persuade Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian leader, to visit Israel in 1977. And it was the same kind of astonishing event as Nixon's visit to China had been in 1972, something absolutely unprecedented in Israeli history. At first, the talks between the two leaders stalled. There were too many differences to overcome. But President Carter brought them together at the presidential retreat at Camp David for 2 weeks in September of 1978 and finally got them to agree on the basis of a treaty, which was then formally signed in the following year. Sadat, the Egyptian leader, paid for it with his life because he was later assassinated by an Islamic extremist inside Egypt who was horrified at the idea of compromising with the enemy Israel. Carter also presided over American relinquishment of the Panama Canal. The canal had been built by the Americans at the beginning of the century, but it had always been taken among Latin Americans as a provocative example of Yankee imperialism. Carter believed that to return the canal zone and the canal itself to Panama was a conciliatory and constructive step in the region. And a bitter debate in the United States Senate was followed by a single vote victory. The majority was just one, enabling the canal to be returned. Carter's economic policies were hamstrung by an awkward combination of slow growth, stagnation, and inflation. Usually you get one or the other. Normally inflation is one of the consequences of rapid economic growth. But in the late 1970s, for factors chiefly arising out of oil politics, something different was happening. The price of oil was rising very, very rapidly as OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, became a more and more effective cartel, restricting the output into the world market as a way of elevating the price. And nearly everything that you buy, oil is a component of its price because it's had to be transported. So if oil prices rise, the price of everything else tends to rise very, very rapidly as well. And as prices rise, that makes it that much more difficult to stimulate new economic growth. In 1979 in particular, the so-called second great gasoline crisis, the first had been after the Yom Kippur War in 1973, there were panicky scenes, long lines at gas stations, as consumers became afraid that there simply would be no gas at all if they weren't very careful. The price rose very, very sharply, and that in turn led to a rise in the importation of fuel economical cars from Germany and Japan. These were very, very bad times for the American automakers, in particular Chrysler, which went bankrupt and had to be bailed out by a federal loan. In 1980, Carter faced a bruising challenge within the Democratic Party for the renomination. Ted Kennedy was the perennial pretender to the Democratic nomination. But as I mentioned earlier, he'd been severely weakened back in 1969 by the Chappaquiddick Ferry affair and the death of Mary Jo Kopechne there, who'd been riding in his car and had probably been his girlfriend. His name was still magically powerful in Massachusetts, for which he was a senator. And he hoped that enough time had now gone by, 11 years had gone by since the incident, that perhaps he'd be able to run a presidential campaign without it damaging him too greatly. But that proved not to be the case. Memories were long enough to inhibit Kennedy from victory. But the Carter administration ended in a pair of complex foreign policy crises, so that although Carter was able to beat off the challenge from Kennedy, he wasn't able to beat off Reagan's challenge and therefore lost the election that November. The worst of these crises was the Iranian Revolution. Students acting on behalf of the Iranian Revolution seized the American embassy in Tehran, which is the capital of Iran, and held 66 of them, the embassy staff. It began in November 1979, and most remained in prison there for the next 444 days. The seizure of the embassy was done in retaliation for President Carter admitting the exiled Shah to the United States for medical treatment. The Shah by then was suffering from cancer. Now, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who'd been an exiled religious leader, had returned to Iran in triumph, and it was he who'd now become, in effect, the new dictator in Iran, and he clearly authorized the seizure. Although they were supposed to be revolutionary students, they were certainly acting under his direction and with his approval. Night after night inside America, the television news covered massive demonstrations in Tehran with huge crowds chanting death to Carter, death to the Shah, death to America, burning the Stars and Stripes and burning effigies of President Carter and Uncle Sam. At home in the United States, there was mounting pressure on Carter to do something more than simply freeze Iranian assets, which had been one of his first steps, and to create a trade embargo. And there was a great campaign of tying yellow ribbons around trees. This was in response to a sentimental song, Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree, to, in other words, to welcome home someone who's been imprisoned or in exile. Finally, Carter authorized a daring military raid for helicopters to fly from American aircraft carriers in the Gulf and to land at the embassy, regain the hostages and take them out of the country. But everything went wrong in the raid itself. The helicopters were damaged by sand blown in the high winds. And worse, a transport plane and one of the helicopters crashed into each other in the desert, causing several American casualties. After which, the force was insufficient, the element of surprise was lost, and the raid had to be called off. And the failure of that raid, perhaps as much as anything in the Carter years, underlined the feeling of impotence of American foreign policy, that America was like a wounded giant. Despite its immense power, it wasn't able to effectively carry out operations elsewhere in the world. And it certainly was one of the factors contributing to President Carter's eventual defeat. This is still only 5 or 6 years after the American withdrawal from Vietnam, and the Vietnam syndrome is still very much on everybody's mind, the fear of getting bogged down in a remote, unwinnable war. Now, it was just at this time that the second great crisis of the late Carter years developed, and it was the Soviet Union's equivalent of Vietnam. This is the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It certainly contributed to poisoning the détente atmosphere, which had prevailed throughout much of the 70s after Nixon's negotiation of the SALT I Treaty. Afghanistan had been the graveyard of other empires' hopes. The British Empire, although it had succeeded in conquering India in the 19th century, had completely failed when it came to Afghanistan. There was a pro-Soviet regime in Kabul, but it couldn't support itself without external aid, just as the South Vietnamese regime had been unable to support itself without American aid. And bit by bit, the Soviet Union found its forces more and more heavily committed in Afghanistan, fighting a great array of hostile warlords who couldn't be suppressed by conventional means because of the nature of the terrain and the guerrilla fighting that they were doing. Well, as the Soviets escalated their commitments in Afghanistan, President Carter retaliated by cutting off American trade with the Soviet Union. That enraged American farmers because year after year, the immense annual American grain surplus was mainly exported to the Soviet Union. And if suddenly that wasn't going to happen, that brought on an economic crisis for the American farmers. And eventually the American government had to underwrite some of their losses. Then Carter refused to let American athletes go to compete in the Olympic Games, which were being held in Moscow. The Senate rejected the second strategic arms limitation talks, which had been negotiated in the early Carter years and had seemed ready for ratification until this sudden deterioration of relations between the two superpowers. So as the election of 1980 approached, all that Carter had tried to achieve seemed to be thwarted by ugly realities. All his hopes were unraveling. He'd hoped to be able to preside over an extension of world peace, but instead world tensions seemed to be ratcheting up rather than down. To rub salt in the wound, Iran, although clearly it intended eventually to release the hostages, waited until the very day of Reagan's inauguration. And once Reagan had actually taken the oath of office, then the hostages were released. It's clearly a calculated insult to Carter not to release them into his care. But in a very magnanimous gesture, the new president, Reagan, at once appointed Carter as his envoy to fly to Europe to meet the hostages as they were flown out of Iran. So at once showing a moment of great political insight on Reagan's part, that on this question, they wouldn't be rivals. Well, the fact that Reagan won in 1980 indicated a shift inside the Republican Party and the new energy of the religious right, which was perhaps the most interesting new force on the scene. The fact that Carter was an evangelical Christian might lead you to suppose that the evangelicals would have been solid behind him, but in fact most of them weren't, because Carter didn't try hard enough, in their view, to roll back the moral changes of the previous 20 years. He didn't insist on pro-family legislation. He didn't try to prevent abortion from continuing. He didn't work hard against the Equal Rights Amendment, issues which for many moral traditionalists were the most important issues affecting the nation. By contrast, they thought that in Reagan they had a candidate who would do those things, even though, ironically, Reagan was the first divorced man to become the president. Ever since the 1920s, and ever since their disappointment after the Scopes Monkey trial, the evangelicals hadn't played a dominant role in politics. And so their re-emergence into the political arena in the late 70s, and particularly the creation of the Moral Majority, which is one of their lobbying groups, just before the 1980 election, caused a great deal of media attention and interest. The most prominent figure was Jerry Falwell. He was the leader of the Moral Majority. And here's a little bit of his rhetoric, a speech that he made in the run-up to the 1980 election. Quote, "I am fully expecting between now and the coming of the Lord that this world is going to experience a spiritual awakening unlike anything in the past. There's going to be an invasion of God on this planet and a changing of lives, real biblical evangelism. There's going to be a terrific harvest of souls somewhere between here and the rapture. I believe that God's role for America is as a catalyst, that he wants to set the spiritual time bomb off right here. If that is the case, America must stay free. And for America to stay free, we must come back to the only principles that God can honor, the dignity of family life, the traditional family, decency, morality, and so on. I just see myself as one to stand in the gap and, under God, with the help of millions of others, to bring the nation back to a moral standard so we can stay free in order that we can evangelize the world." Now, you may notice in there, he talks about the rapture, a harvest of souls somewhere between here and the rapture. Falwell was a dispensational premillennialist, which means that he believed that before the second coming of Jesus, and before the 7 years of war and catastrophe culminating in the Battle of Armageddon, which is foreseen in the book of Revelation, those who were already saved, the Christians who were already saved, would be raptured, that is, taken up into the air, so that they'd be spared the ordeal of the last days. He was one of many fundamentalists in America who believed that the last days were very close, that the rapture was close, but that America had got to be ready, it had got to be the nation which embodied the Christian values before this could happen. The conservative Republicans had suffered a very severe defeat back in 1964 under the candidacy of Barry Goldwater, but in the meantime they'd been working very, very hard to build up their control of the Republican Party at the local levels, and the fact that their candidate could now win demonstrated how successful they'd been. For them, Reagan was a wonderful candidate, because he'd been famous before he got into politics, famous first in radio in the 30s, then in Hollywood films, and then in television. He was handsome, very, very well attuned to working with the media, and had an air of relaxation. He wasn't tense and wrought up like most right-wingers. Earlier right-wing candidates, including Goldwater, had been hectic and angry and sometimes slightly paranoid figures, sometimes fearing mad conspiracies, such as that important people in national life were really communist agents. Well, there's none of that about Reagan. He brought to the Republican right a mood of relaxation and possession. And he seemed to embody, to many people, the all-American values. And in fact, as a Hollywood actor, he'd been distilling the all-American values in many of his movie roles. That's why he was so popular. He had an excellent manner on camera, whereas poor old President Carter had been terribly stiff and awkward. And whereas Carter had been unlucky, Reagan was lucky. For example, within a few weeks of being inaugurated, he survived an assassination attempt. He was shot by a young man called John Hinckley Jr., who had been stalking a movie star, Jodie Foster, and was looking for a dramatic way to win Jodie Foster's attention. And he reckoned that by shooting the president, he'd certainly get it. Well, Reagan was badly wounded by a gunshot, but was able to joke with the doctors as he was taken into the hospital, put on a very brave face, and emerged from hospital more popular than ever. Voters were amazed that this man, already elderly, could nevertheless survive an attack of this kind and come out as seemingly as strong as ever. It was his persona as much as his policies which helped ensure Reagan's continuing popularity and then his re-election in the election of 1984. Republican ideologues in his administration were sometimes dismissed when they became an embarrassment, but Reagan himself always seemed to sail through unscathed. Although his administration was dogged by scandals of various kinds, somehow they didn't seem to quite touch him directly. I mentioned in talking about the environment that his Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, eventually had to be dismissed as an embarrassment to his own party because he was so inflexibly opposed to environmentalists. Here's a wonderful description by the conservative columnist George Will of James Watt. Quote, he acts like the machine in the garden. When he testifies beneath bright television lights, his high glistening forehead, his electric smile, and his eyes flashing behind metal-rimmed glasses, call to mind a 1955 Buick, chromium-plated. When he speaks, you half expect to hear gears grind, and you do, sort of. He has no patience with the to-ing and fro-ing practiced by persons who understand that in politics, the straightest line between two points is rarely the easiest route. He speaks almost too clearly, indifferent to the bureaucratic art of constructing whole paragraphs perfectly devoid of substance. His cocksureness, his thirst for conflict, his tone deafness regarding his own shrillness have invigorated environmental groups. Well, a wonderful little comment there by George Will, pointing out why Watt had got to go. He was the kind of right-wing ideologue which tends to bring trouble in politics, which is so much of an arena of give and take and conciliation and careful maneuvering. And as Will says, sometimes the art of not really saying much while appearing to be very high-minded. Well, in the election of 1984, the Democratic candidate was lackluster. It was Walter Mondale, who'd been Carter's vice president, hadn't made a particularly vivid impression in the Carter administration, just as most vice presidents don't, and wasn't really able to establish distinct and vivid policy positions of his own. His most daring step was to select a woman to be his vice president, his vice presidential candidate, but that backfired as well. It was Geraldine Ferraro, a New York congresswoman. On the one hand, she claimed to be feisty, in charge, and tough enough for the job. But then, as journalists' investigations into her husband's shady business dealings began to emerge, because, of course, every candidate is very, very closely investigated by the press corps, she then had to start claiming that merely as his wife, she simply hadn't known that he'd been involved in all these affairs, which in turn, of course, made her seem weak and out of touch, one of the contributing factors to the Democrats' loss that year. The other great dilemma that the Democratic Party faced in 84 was this. One of the contenders for the Democratic nomination was Jesse Jackson, who'd inherited some of Martin Luther King Jr.'s mantle as the presumptive leader of the African-American community. King himself had never been involved in actual electoral politics. He'd always had the stance of a prophetic outsider. But Jackson couldn't quite make up his mind which side of that fence he stood on and had a foot in both camps. He attempted to build what he called a rainbow coalition of African-Americans, women, Hispanics, and other minorities, and implicitly to move national policy in a leftward direction. But that had the effect of scaring away a lot of middle-of-the-road Democrats who decided that, this time at least, they were going to vote for Reagan, and Reagan profited from the votes of what were called the Reagan Democrats. That was the anguish of the Democratic Party. They needed the minority voters, and they needed to try to keep the moral high ground and the heritage of the civil rights movement. But if they did that, they couldn't make it the basis of an electoral majority. Now, Reagan, back to President Reagan himself, he abandoned the bipartisan consensus of recent decades in both domestic and foreign policy. In his economic policies, he espoused what was called the supply-side revolution. Essentially, it meant this, that by making dramatic tax cuts, you take the gamble that as tax rates fall, more money is available for investment, so economic growth accelerates, which in turn generates more tax revenues, even though it's coming out of a lower rate. It was a policy advanced by economic theorists like Milton Friedman and George Gilder, and seemed to Reagan a very good idea. The Republicans also had an awkward electoral coalition. On the one hand, the pro-family people, the moral majority types, who wanted a lot of federal intervention in things like family policy. But on the other hand, the libertarian Republicans, whose view is the government is best, which governs least, just leaves us to our own devices and lets us get on with it. It was really the libertarian side of republicanism which gained more than the pro-family and evangelical side. And so Reagan, despite his rhetoric and despite periodic visits to the moral majority and to fundamentalist groups, actually did little to press legislation in favor of family policy or in favor of school prayers or against abortion. The moral majority members themselves went through a slow process of disillusionment when they found how little headway they were making. But Reagan found it very difficult indeed to carry through on his promise to diminish the scale of the federal government, because, of course, each department of the federal government lobbied very, very tenaciously to hang on to its own existence. Every bureaucracy wants to make sure that it continues into the indefinite future because its job holders' livelihood is at stake. So Reagan's actual ability to diminish the federal government, as he promised, proved very difficult. Meanwhile, he wanted to address the Cold War more vigorously. So he rapidly escalated the military budget, creating greater and greater deficits. He brought the battleship Missouri out of mothballs. He mounted a quick campaign against a left-wing regime in the island of Grenada. In every way, showed toughness and resolve, and described the Soviet Union as the evil empire, inflammatory confrontational rhetoric, rather than the conciliatory approach which had been followed by both Nixon and Carter, at least Carter in his early years. Now, Reagan's militant posture towards the Soviet Union was compounded by an aggressive policy in Latin America. He supported anti-communist guerrillas, the Contras, in the Nicaraguan Civil War, and he favored the El Salvadoran regime, which was fighting off an attack by left-wing guerrillas of its own. One of the bitter outcomes of the Carter foreign policy, the human rights foreign policy, had been this. Sometimes, when you abandon your support for a bad regime, you don't get a better one, you get a worse one. That had been the message of both Iran and Nicaragua. And Gene Kirkpatrick, working in the Reagan administration, made a distinction between authoritarian regimes, which she said might not be as scrupulous about human rights as we would like, a distinction between them and totalitarian regimes. Kirkpatrick said, and Reagan's foreign policy staff followed this view, we can support the authoritarians, but not the totalitarians. It was certainly a stepping back from the high-minded human rights view that Carter had taken. The Star Wars program prepared to militarize even beyond the Earth's atmosphere. This research and development began in a new generation of satellite-based missile defenses. In other words, to have in orbit around the Earth devices which could shoot down Soviet missiles as they were launched against the United States. Very costly, their viability was questionable, and of course they were taken to be provocative offensive weapons because they might be used in conjunction with an American first strike. Well, Reagan's Teflon image, that is, the ability for scandals to apparently slide off him, enabled Reagan even to weather the embarrassing Iran-Contra scandal, which marred his second term in office. Congress had passed legislation called the Boland Amendments, prohibiting American aid to the Nicaraguan Contras, this group of guerrillas. But the Reagan government got around it by covertly selling weapons to Iran, even though officially Iran remained one of America's enemies, and then using the money to support the Contras. And Reagan's operatives justified themselves with the claim that the trade would moderate the extremists in Iran and would lead to the release of some Americans who were held hostage in Lebanon and in that way help bring down the Sandinista regime. In other words, the long-term outcome would be a good one, even though the policy itself might violate explicit American policy. Well, the Nicaraguan government shot down a CIA plane carrying some of these weapons to the Contras. And a survivor of the crew who was captured confessed what was going on, and that became the leak which led to a great scandal inside the United States. Another press sensation followed, with congressional hearings featuring Colonel Oliver North, who justified his unconstitutional activities by claiming the necessity of national security, claiming, yes, it's true that sometimes we have to conduct policies which may not live up to our highest ideals, but we do it in the name of forestalling something much worse. President Reagan was clearly involved in these affairs, but claimed not to have understood that arms were being traded for hostages. There was talk then of the impeachment of the president, but congressmen were very reluctant to do it because they knew that Reagan remained very, very popular personally as president, even though clearly some of his policies had overstepped the bounds of legality. And no congressman was willing to lead the charge for impeachment with the knowledge that it might well cost him his own political life. So this is clearly a case where Reagan's own apparent invulnerability inhibited his full prosecution. The press were always much gentler with Reagan than they had been with Nixon, and Reagan was correspondingly treated more gently than his predecessor had been. When he left the White House, Reagan lived on into the 1990s, though beginning to suffer from Alzheimer's disease. Unlike Jimmy Carter, he'd never worked very hard. Reagan had always been a master of delegation of authority. He took things easy, worked a few hours every day, but didn't overstress himself, whereas Carter had been a workaholic who worked 16 or 17-hour days and couldn't delegate authority easily. And yet there's no question that by most measures, Reagan's had been an infinitely more successful presidency than Carter's had been. But both of them are very amazing figures to have been presidents of the United States. First, the born-again Christian from the Georgia backwoods, and second, the Hollywood star. Nothing could have seemed more unlikely in the early 1970s, and yet in the context of what was actually playing out, it made perfect sense in the history of the late 70s and the 1980s.